going down, and you're invited for what they selling. We ain't buying. There is no running, there is no hiding. There's only fighting or dying. It's going down, and you're invited for what they selling. We ain't buying. There is no running, there is no hiding. There's only fighting or dying.
It's Going Down is a digital community center from anarchist, anti-fascist, autonomous, anti-capitalist, and anti-colonial movements. Our mission is to provide an autonomous and resilient platform to publicize and promote revolutionary theory and action.
Go to itsgoingdown.org for daily updates. Check out our online store for ways to donate and rate and follow us on iTunes if you like this podcast.
My name is Eric Larson, and I am an activist, independent journalist, and anarchist, anarchist scholar of sorts. I have been identified as an anarchist for pretty much my whole adult life. I've also worked extensively as a journalist, covering politics, finance, economics, business. And I have written a couple of books. One is called The People's Pension, Defending Social Security Since Reagan, which is a history of the debate on privatizing Social Security. I also wrote a book a couple of years ago called The Duty to Stand Aside, which is about the relationship between George Orwell and Alex Comfort during World War II. It's really about the clash between anarcho-pacifists and the left during World War II. And the book that I've just written is entitled The Operating System, An Anarchist Theory of the State. And what it's really about is it's an attempt to define the state from an anarchist perspective. What is this thing? What's its relationship to capital? How does it control our lives? And it's, I hope, the beginning of a conversation that can be had in the anarchist community and beyond about the nature of the state in our time, and specifically what we can do to escape it, save ourselves from it, save ourselves from the crises that it's invented. And that's really what prompted me to write this book.
Yeah, we're excited to talk about it. We've got a copy of the book and been able to look through it. Also, you have sort of kind of like a made-for-the-internet version of one of the chapters in the book that presents sort of like the main thesis, I guess, that's on Roar magazine. We'll link to that, obviously, in the show notes. And some of the questions are based off that as well. But I encourage people to check that out if you kind of want a taste of the book a little bit. But just to kind of dive into it, talk to us about the book and what are some of the core central ideas in it?
What really led me to want to write this is this realization that within the anarchist tradition, there's the attempt to define the state, which is this thing that we're against, this thing that we feel that we're fighting against. It's very sketchy. And I wanted to try to come up with a more holistic view of what the state is, where it came from, and how it acts upon us, as well as how we participate in it. And the basic idea I'm working from goes back to what I consider to be the beginnings of the modern state, which is in the late 15th century, the beginning of the Renaissance, when coherent nation states started to appear in Europe, England, France, Spain, the classic examples, states that have that are recognizable, at least to some extent, from our vantage point today. And I was trying to figure out, you know, what is the difference between a modern state and other states that we had in the past? What's the difference between something like the United States, for example, and the Roman Empire or the Persian Empire or Ming Dynasty China? And it seemed to me that the critical difference, the thing that happened 500 years or so ago that gave us the state that we have now, was an understanding by the people in charge, kings, monarchs, business oligarchs, etc., that there was tremendous power to be gained by turning the population and the resources of the territory that the state occupied into an engine for economic growth. This was the era when kings and queens started to encourage exploration and colonization. Imperialism came into being. There was an effort to harness the population to produce more and more economic growth, which produced more and more wealth for the state, which enabled the state to start wars, to prosecute wars successfully, to expand its territory, to deepen its control of the people in the territory that it commanded. And that's really been kind of a cycle which we've seen going on ever since then. The modern state really, you know, I say at one point in the book that the modern state it doesn't just have a relationship with capitalism. It is a capitalist. It was the original capitalist. It's the original engine that focused on creating economic growth, relentless economic growth. And of course, the way that's changed our world is dramatic compared to the world we had before. You have a single model effectively of the state that is enforced and that's expanded all around the world. You know, I like to say that the state was Europe's most successful export because that model of running a society, of managing a society, has been exported everywhere into parts of the world that never had a state, that even 50 years ago or 100 years ago in some cases never had a state the way we think about it. So it's covered the planet. It has created a sort of a global economy that's a free market capitalist economy that essentially tries to create a global monoculture. That states collectively attempt to impose the same economic model everywhere. We call that globalization. We call it neoliberalism. But really, in some form or another, it's been going on for over five centuries. And the problems it creates are really coming to a head in our time. Relentless economic growth means, for example, overuse of fossil fuels. That's caused global warming. It's caused dramatic disruption of traditional communities and disparities in wealth that have created huge, I guess I would say, destabilization all over the planet. And it has sparked enormous migrations in our time, just unprecedented movements of people from one part of the world to another, seeking some kind of way to make a living amidst collapsing economies and neoliberal systems that really have no room for most of the workers in them. And that's the kind of thing, you know, movements of populations aren't necessarily a bad thing. They can create a truly multicultural global world for us. On the other hand, it could result in huge ethnic and racial oppression, economic exploitation on a scale we've never seen before. So we're reaching a point now where, at least from a human point of view, and the point of view of the Earth, we're reaching a kind of a crisis of the state that's a product of this 500-year-old system that has expanded itself relentlessly. One of the things I try and do with the book is give a kind of an idea of, by analogy, of what is this thing? What can we compare it to in our daily lives that gives us an idea of what it really is? And the comparison I make with the state is with a computer operating system, a Microsoft Word or a Mac iOS or a system like that that essentially tries to become the framework for our whole lives online, that tells us you can do everything through this system. And that's essentially what the state does. It tries to create a kind of a holistic world for us, almost like a simulacrum that we all participate in. You don't need anything outside the state. Capital, the property economy, it's all there for you. Nothing in traditional society cannot be replaced by this thing. And that's essentially the trap we're in. Anybody who's used Microsoft and has this queasy feeling that we're being told that that's the whole world, or that we, that Microsoft would like to think, like us to think that that's the whole world. It's very similar to what the state, does to us in real life. And so I use that as a kind of a way to, as a shorthand for how to think about this, to how to think about the state in our lives. And I think that, that it's important to observe, for example, that computer operating systems are something that was very much nurtured into being by the state. And so it makes a certain amount of sense that it would reflect the reality that the state attempts to create for us. And so, so there's a kind of a, there's a kind of a tight connection there. So that's a little bit of a sketch of some of the overall basic ideas that I, detail in the book.
I'm curious, as an anarchist, I mean, like, as, like you said, as we kind of get to this point where we're just seeing crisis after crisis, you know, the rise of authoritarian populisms and neo-fascism, the climate crisis, just complete destabilization and huge inequalities. Why do you think people still cling to the state as, like, the way in which society should be organized?
Well, probably the most successful thing the state has done in our time is convince us that it is what there is. It's the state is so pervasive and so comprehensive, especially the partnering with capital, that it's hard for people to conceive of something outside it. So there's a kind of a flight to safety. A crisis happens. This is why depressions happen, great recessions happen, disastrous wars happen. And rather than shaking people's faith in the state, they seem to reinforce it because people want to fly to safety. They want to get back to something they perceive as protecting them and giving them some reassurance that things are stable and will stay the same. The problem is the problem with that is that the state has actually not been very successful at dealing with crises. The death toll from wars and violence has just grown exponentially over the last century, which is the most powerful century in the state's history, for the state. Its ability to handle economic crises has eroded, if anything, in the last 30 or 40 years. And as we've seen with COVID, its ability, and I'm not talking about individual states here, I'm talking about the whole system of states, its ability to cope with an emergency like a pandemic is shockingly bad. To the extent that it has plans, they go out the window as soon as the crisis happens. You know, we are taught to some extent to think of the state as something that replaced a period of chaos, something that people rely, that's better than what we had before because the state provides stability, security, et cetera. In fact, it has a very poor track record of doing that. So that's part of the problem here is that it doesn't live up to its billing. On the other hand, it benefits from the fact that people think that it is what there is. And that if you want to go to something stable or go to some place for protection, that's where you can. That's the only thing you can go to. So it has a certain amount to do with cultural conditioning as well. What we're taught, how we're taught to think about our lives. So those are some of the issues there.
In the book, you state that the state itself is largely an economic endeavor. Tease that out a little bit. Explain that.
State is an economic endeavor in that really, I think what separates out modern states as we have them today from the different kinds of political systems that we had before that is that none of those were as laser focused on achieving economic growth. Around about the time of the Renaissance, rulers in Europe realized that that they can get a leg up on their opponents, on their enemies, on other states, other rulers, by promoting rapid economic growth within their territories. And that means exploiting human labor. That it means exploiting agricultural and other natural resources that they have by cultivating new technologies. The obsession with these things really dates back to that period. And what it was all about was giving rulers a leg up on their competitors. And it became a kind of a cycle. You start to produce greater economic growth. The state's power grows. The society becomes more organized, more complex. Literally, the territory it covers grows. The amount of control it has over its own people grows. And as a result, the state needs more resources in order to keep all of that under control. So you need more economic growth, which means more expansion, which means more, again, an increasingly complex society, which is more difficult and expensive to run, which means you need more economic growth, et cetera. And the state in doing this is aided and abetted by capital, because harnessing financial capital is the quickest way to achieve growth. That's the one thing that we have that we've seen over the last 500 years that's really consistent. And so what you have is a what you get is sort of the state as a kind of an economic engine that that will do anything to keep growing, keep becoming more wealthy. And that means, again, extraction of fossil fuels, enormous increases in the demand for energy, enormous increases in territory that is put under development, and the need to harness every human being as much as possible as part of this system. So that's I kind of look at the state as the thing in a way which created capitalism rather than the other way around, which is I think more the way Marxists often see it. Capital could not exist without the state. The state could not achieve the kind of economic growth it wants to achieve without capital. So there's a symbiotic relationship there between the two.
There's kind of this notion that the state is needed to coordinate us out of, you know, these massive crises like climate change, even though ironically, you know, governments are one of the biggest consumers of oil. And I'm just curious, you know, how would you respond to this notion that we need the state essentially to deal with kind of like complex issues or, you know, the current crisis that we find ourselves in?
Well, in the case of the environmental movement, I think that the really urgent message here is this, is that the state is so invested in rapid economic growth that it is incapable of shifting gears and adopting an environmental set of policies. It's a mismatch. It's a very profound mismatch. The state is not going to save us in terms of saving the earth, preserving the environment, ending the kind of atmospheric degradation that we see happening now. It simply is not set up to do that. It has too many other urgent objectives. You can't have the kind of you can't have the state if you have to dial back economic growth or recalibrate it so that it doesn't have this destructive relationship with the earth. It's a profound mismatch. The state is not going to save us. And I think this is something that you see a lot on the left. And as I worked on this book, it became more and more dramatically clear to me that too much of the time on the left, you see people saying the system doesn't work. The system is a failure. The system is working against us. Okay, let's reform it. Now we're going to reform it. And what that really means when people say reform it is perpetuate it, is recreate it, reproduce it, perpetuate it, which in the end simply compounds the problem. It kicks the can down the road. It keeps the problem going. It does not solve problems like income inequality, population movements, climate change.
You know, years ago, and it's going down, we wrote something on a column about this video the CIA produced about megacities. And it was talking about sort of the cities that would come by, you know, 2050 or something like that. And it was basically talking about how more and more people are being pushed into big cities and that, you know, the problems of climate change and wealth inequality are just going to continue to build. And that they were talking about sort of the system of management that they wanted to go towards was just more and more oppression and more surveillance of populations locked in these cities and making sure to basically crack down on the ungovernable elements. I just think it's interesting to point out that if you look at sort of kind of like the theory that's being produced, like inside the state, they wouldn't necessarily disagree with anything that we're saying other than, of course, get rid of the state. You know, they essentially agree that like the state is part of this process, which is making the world more unequal, you know, more destabilized, leading to massive crisis. Their only solution, though, is just basically to pour more police onto the fire, and hopefully that will contain it from breaking down.
I mean, coming from the CIA, that's an astonishingly honest assessment. That is the world that we get if we stick with the state capital system that we have now, is one that's going to create a more bifurcated society of rich and poor, that's going to require more security, more oppression. And as far as climate change goes, it's, well, you know, everybody head to the highest ground they can find, which, of course, will be the people with the most money. There's, I think, a kind of a really startlingly frightening acknowledgement there in what the CIA came up with, that this is the direction we're heading if we stick with it. What they don't say is if we stick with the state. But that therein, I think, lies a certain amount of honesty too, that if we're not going to get rid of it, this is the way we're going. This is the direction things are going to go.
Well, moving forward, you write, but the modern state is a much larger, more complex phenomenon, a comprehensive means of organizing and exercising power that, once it is launched, expands to cover more and more aspects of existence according to a direction and a logic of its own. Can you explain that more, just this drive to just grow and grow and grow?
Yeah, again, it's a kind of a drive for power, which begins with this notion that economic growth is the thing that's going to is the thing that produces power. If you don't have that, your state will fail. And what I'm really trying to say in that passage is that, how do you produce economic growth if you're the state, if you're the capitalist system? Well, it means you have to harness your natural resources. You have to harness your people. People become not individuals, not communities. They become economic assets. And this is the way we've been taught, really, for the last 50 years, at least, to think of the human community in the age of neoliberalism, is that we are not individuals. We are economic assets, which may be viable, maybe may not be, depending on what our skill set is, that the earth is a store of natural resources that are to be harnessed for economic growth, not for anything else, that if they can't justify themselves on the basis of economic growth, they can't justify themselves. We are, as individuals, we are taught that, first of all, that's all we are. Individuals are something that the capitalist state economy can work with. Communities are not. Communities are something to be taken and to be smashed up and to be reconstituted as economic assets that can help the state and to help the capitalist system to grow. You can see traces of this kind of thinking all the way back to the 16th century. And it's only grown more and more ruthless and relentless since then. As consumers, as producers of goods, as producers of even of you know, cultural or intellectual capital that can be used to make money, we're part of the system. We're essentially told that we're part of the system all the time, and that's why the state needs to convince us that that it is the entire framework of our lives, that there's no need to think of ourselves outside of capitalism, outside of the administrative structure of the state. If we go off the grid, we're going into nothing. We are going into alienation and death. Many people have found that that's not the case, that that's a place where they can find community and rebuild some kind of a human existence. But the state would have us think otherwise. And that's what that's the kind of, when I use the term simulacrum, that's what I mean. That it, essentially it gives us a kind of an artificial world to live in that it convinces us somehow is real.
You go on to write, quote, "The three main human crises we mentioned earlier, climate change, economic inequality, and mass social disruption leading to mass migration, are the cumulative product of this self-perpetuating process." Can you just dig into that a little bit more too?
And, you know, I think we could maybe add one other thing, which would be pandemics. That all of these problems stem in one way or another from the structure that the state has put in place over the last 500 years. Climate change is the result of over-harvesting and abuse of natural resources. Income inequality stems from the relentless desire of the state and capital to accumulate wealth and to exploit it, to augment its own power. Mass migration is the result of the cultural and disruption of communities, economic disruption of communities that the state's been responsible over the last 500 years. And increasingly in the last 100 years, that without the sort of relentless expansion of the European state system and of the capitalist system that goes along with it, those disruptions wouldn't have happened, and we wouldn't have masses of people being forced to leave places that are becoming economically ruined, that are becoming environmentally ruined, etc. So pandemics, obviously, it has a lot to do with the same thing, with the relentless encroachment on nature that we get with the state and capitalism, and with the disruption of communities that sends people all over the world. If you want to have a global economy, which is what we're told is the kind of the holy grail, you're going to have pandemics. So all of these problems are directly related to they're kind of the chicken coming home to roost in terms of the system that we've accepted for the last 500 years.
Best friend's older brother died. He fell from these cliffs. The river washed him away. The current pulled him downstream. And our lives float in the headlines. So we parked these cars in Paris' garage. Listen to the lullaby. War all of the time. In the shadow. The New York skyline, we grew up too fast.
I'm curious what you make of the current possibilities caused by the post-George Floyd rebellion in terms of so many people now questioning the need and validity of the police and therefore the state. And what do you think the anarchist movement does with this fundamental shift in the way that so many people are thinking about kind of this basic aspect of society?
The movement for Black Lives, first of all, is one of the most hopeful political developments I've seen for the last 30 years. And the reason, at least in the United States, and the reason is very simple, because Black Lives Matter isn't a political party. It doesn't, it's a mass movement. It's the biggest mass movement we've seen in this country in years. And it's not engaged in electoral politics. It's engaged in activism. It's engaged in protest. It's engaged in politics that's not really contained simply within that you can't contain simply within the state. Black Lives Matter addresses something that's bigger than that. It does it through people, activists, people in the streets, not through politicians. And I think that this is the way politics has to go if we're going to begin to get beyond the state. Boycotts have become a more common strategy on the left, the left broadly speaking. And this is an incredibly hopeful thing because it directly attacks this fundamental objective of economic growth. It's saying we are going to hobble economic growth if we can't have the kind of world we want. It's saying that we will make this grind to a halt. I was very encouraged a couple of months ago when Palestinian people in Israel and Palestine staged a general strike. These are the kinds of strategies that we have to follow because, again, they're not about electoral politics. They're about attacking the system itself, whether it's because of racism, whether it's because of environmental crimes, whether it's because of nationalism. It's attacking the whole system. And this is what we need to, where politics increasingly needs to shift in the future if we're going to come up with a way to, as I like to say, to escape the state. It's not just a protest against the state. It's literally a step on the way to shaking it off.
It's interesting you use that type of language. I noticed that in the book, Escape the State. Just to be clear, I feel like some people, when they hear that, they might think of like dropout culture or something like that.
When I say escape the state, it can mean going off the grid. It can mean dropout culture. Those are ways to begin to at least get some idea of what escaping the state could be like. I think that today we need to go a little further than that. I lay out a really tentative or sketch out a really tentative roadmap in the last couple of chapters of my book, in which I emphasize the need for social revolution. That yes, we can create temporary autonomous zones. Yes, we can go off the grid, but we need to create networks between people and communities that do this, of networks of support and networks that can begin to coalesce into a real social revolution, which then can lead to a political revolution. The problem with revolutionary change in the last 200 plus years, 250 years almost, is that it always ends in recreating the state. We replace one state regime with another one, or we replace one with another, which then attempts to recreate the one it replaced, basically. And we have to get beyond this. And so we have to think about creating a new consciousness and a new social structure now, rather than waiting until after we've overthrown the current one. That's, I think, the tricky part. It's also the really hopeful part, because a movement like Black Lives Matter didn't need a whole lot of infrastructure to come together, responded very, very quickly to people's rage. And it a movement came out of that almost overnight. So it is doable. It's living proof that we don't need the state to organize. We don't need the state to bring about change. As a matter of fact, trying to use the state itself can be profoundly counterproductive. So that, I think, is some idea of the roadmap we need to follow.
So there's a chapter in the book about the state and COVID-19. I'm curious if you can kind of get into that and talk about your thoughts on that connection.
Yeah, I start out chapter one of the book actually talking about COVID-19. And it's funny. I mean, when I was writing, I was very well aware of the fact that I was writing in the relatively early stages of this crisis, which was obviously going to go on for a long time. And I thought, well, am I going to be writing something that is going to be dated? And I thought, well, no, because whatever happens next, the initial screw-ups, the initial mistakes were made very, very early on with COVID. And they extended back earlier. They extended back to the hollowing out of public health facilities, public health infrastructure by the state in many, many countries. It started with the lack of interest in any kind of preparation that would leave assets unused in case of an emergency. That simply wasn't part of the economic structure that capitalists like to follow for the last 30 or 40 years. And so essentially we were left high and dry as far as everything from masks to, in the case of India, oxygen. And what this really comes down to is that COVID was a frightening example of how incapable the state system is with its obsession with economic growth, how incapable it is of dealing with an emergency like this. We have institutions like the World Health Organization, which essentially are hollowed out, which are not able to work independently of the states that fund it. We have a United Nations that's ineffective. We have political leaders who are opportunists. The whole thing has been a disaster because of the very institution, the state, which we were led to believe was set up to stop this kind of thing from happening or to enable us to respond to it in an effective way. Every time something like this happens, we're told this is the last time. Next time it will be better. Next time we will do better. And that doesn't happen. I think you can extend this analysis a little bit. For the last 100 years, ever since the First World War, we've been told that every big war that this country fights is the big one. It's the last one. It's the one that will make everybody free. It's the one that will solve every one of our problems. Right down to the invasion of Iraq, which was supposed to revolutionize and democratize the Middle East and turn it into a model neoliberal society. It didn't happen. It wasn't going to happen. And yet that was the claim that was made. And I think that in one area after another, that's what you see with the state and with capital is, trust us, we'll do it right this time, and it doesn't happen.
What do you make of, though, people like Trump or various segments of the right kind of feeding off of and capitalizing on people's mistrust of the state in terms of like weaponizing like COVID-19 conspiracy theories or conspiracy theories about the vaccine? What do you make of that?
Well, the state, one of the big tools that the state has had in its arsenal for the last 500 years is misdirection. It's a problem comes up, and the trick of politicians like Trump is to direct our attention somewhere else. Hey, no, that's not where the problem is. The problem is over here with these migrants, or the problem is here with China, or the problem is over here with quote unquote liberals or anarchists or these undesirable people. That's one of the oldest tricks in the book. And it's dangerous because the real objective is, of course, is to divide us from each other and make it more difficult for people on the receiving end to organize against the state. There's a kind of a tendency of people on the right to invoke, you know, small government or I'm anti-state or I'm anti-government as a way in, on a certain level to appear cool. It sounds good. It sounds anarchist in a kind of a superficial way even. But really what it's about is getting people to, is persuading people not to work collectively, not to work cooperatively. Let the state do it. Let capital do it. Let the free enterprise system do it. But for God's sake, don't all you people get together and try and do it for yourselves in a collective or cooperative way. That's really what they're saying when they attack government and so forth. They're generally, they don't attack the military. They don't attack the police, people on the right. What they attack is everything from quote unquote welfare to Social Security to fair housing to any of these things that actually require some social solidarity and community solidarity to make work. That is the one thing that the state funded. And this goes back to another thing is the idea, which was popular in the 70s and 80s of the last century, that government could be the answer to all sorts of social problems. Fundamentally, the government is not interested in being the answer. It's only interested to the extent that it can secure the kind of economic growth it needs and to continue to perpetuate itself. That is essentially what people like Trump harness right-wing elements in the population to prevent.
You're listening to It's Going Down, part of the Channel Zero Anarchist Podcast Network. Follow us online at itsgoingdown.org and on Twitter at IGD_news. If you like and appreciate this podcast, go to itsgoingdown.org/shop and give us a one-time donation. Sign up to donate monthly or donate through Bitcoin. Again, that's itsgoingdown.org/shop to support. And now, back to the show. Well, we're going to switch gears here and talk about some kind of broader topics. And I know that your book is focused on the modern state, and we'll talk about that in a second. But kind of in school and in the mass media, you know, we're always told as we're growing up that life before the creation of the state was nasty, brutish, and short, and that government and the state came out of sort of a collective need for order, protection, and defense. I'm just curious, you know, as you see it, what was the reality of the creation of states in general?
Let's sort of turn back the clock a little bit. I mean, if you look at the Middle Ages in Europe, let's say, and I focus on Europe because that's where the modern state began, and the modern state still is fundamentally, I think, a European creation. It's been grafted onto other parts of the world, but that's where it grew up. In the centuries before the modern state was set up, you had almost a constellation of different kinds of political forms. You had, in Europe, you had feudal kingdoms, you had feudal baronies, you had free cities, you had commercial oligarchies, you had peasant cooperatives and communes, you had urban communes, you had theocratic communities. An array of different ways to organize politically. The state began a process of essentially grinding it all down to one, whether it's a dictatorship or a kingdom or a liberal democracy or whatever, the structure is the same and the relationship with capital is the same. So that was the difference that we had when the modern state started to take hold. And the differences between the previous period, you know, I detailed, I think there's about 12 fundamental differences that I outline here. The biggest one of which is this relentless emphasis on economic growth, but also states rule directly. They don't rule through proxies. They create bureaucracies. they create armies, which are almost quasi-states within themselves. They focus on growth. They focus on the individual as an economic engine. They create a system of states that are mutually reinforcing. I think this is one of the interesting aspects of it, is that there's never really been a period in the history of the modern state when you've only had states. There's always been a kind of a system of states that that support each other, that mimic each other, that learn from each other. So that, you know, I in my book, I tend to spell the state with a capital S, because there's a kind of a model that all of them contribute to in a kind of a symbiotic way. So the answer really is that the state is a modern creation. It's almost synonymous, I would say, with the modern world, because it molded it. It's what gave us imperialism, colonialism, really ruthless labor exploitation outside of agriculture. It gave us the obsession with technological development that we have today, which vastly outstrips our, you know, ability to think about ourselves as social beings. And it's created this, it's really what's created this sort of, alienated, atomized modern culture that everybody complains about and nobody does anything about. So those are some of the elements there.
So if the history of statism is it being imposed on people, then how do states go about doing that historically?
Well, that's evolved over time. I mean, in the early days in Europe, there were a couple of things. First of all, was the buildup of bigger armies and standing armies, which kept people in order and started to enforce borders. That initially states were there in a way to keep populations from moving around, and to contain populations. So you had armies which did that, and bureaucracies which issued people identity papers and so forth. Those really are an invention of the modern state. As time went on and societies within the modern state became more complex, it became not just a matter of beating people over the head and threatening them with violence. It became a matter of getting their acquiescence, of gaining their loyalty, gaining their support. And that's when you had nation state began, where states were presumed, you know, starting really in the 18th century, to be built around a people or a culture or a common language. And that was really a way to cement people's loyalty to the state. You know, nationalism becomes kind of a cult in the 19th century. It's almost a replacement for a religion. Then you have, and so that's one way that that the state enforces loyalty. One of the concepts I have in the book I have kind of a slightly clunky way to refer to it, which is it's the core identity group. What the core identity group is within a state, it's that portion of the population that is essential for the elites to maintain the loyalty of, without which they would have a problem controlling things. So in the United States, it would be white people of European origin have always been sort of the core identity group here. In France, it would be French speaking people. In India, and we begin to see sort of the problems here, is that the core identity group increasingly is Hindus, with Muslims being left on the outside as not being really the people who the state was set up for. Now, that wasn't really actually the way independent India was set up, but increasingly that's the profile that it's assuming under the Modi government. In Israel and Palestine, it's people of Jewish origin as opposed to people of Muslim or Palestinian Arab origin who are the core identity group. And maintaining the loyalty of the core identity group is a huge part of what the state is all about. And it doesn't require necessarily a lot of loyalty to the state itself. You can talk to people on the white supremacist right in the United States, and they have plenty of bad things to say about government and about the state, but they have an enormous loyalty to the military and to the police, which are institutions they feel embody their values and their interests. And institutions like that become a kind of a focal point for the core identity group, and the state encourages people to identify with it, with those institutions, because that's a way of keeping them loyal on a sort of a basic level. So there, and we can see that in our popular culture with the way police are celebrated in Hollywood, on television, et cetera, for example. So you have a kind of a cultural nationalism that the state encourages and that maintains the loyalty of this essential group. And that's the dynamic we see. We've seen it really, really dramatically in the last few years as the pushback against Black Lives Matter has happened.
So yeah, let's go back to the point you made about the modern state is European in origin. Yeah, talk about that, why that is so. I mean, because we all know that there were vast empires and states and city-states and, you know, all over the world, you know, along with autonomous, decentralized, stateless societies. But why would you argue that the modern state itself is European?
Well, two reasons, really. First of all, because the state we have today retains this obsessive interest in economic growth as a source of power. That's something you didn't really see in previous centuries. I mean, the Roman Empire ruled over a vast variety of peoples who essentially lived in self-contained or more or less self-contained communities. There was a great deal of trade, but there was a stability among the populations, and there was a self-contained or I guess subsistence system in most parts of the empire. That was something that the modern state was not interested in perpetuating. It was interested in turning everybody into a source of economic propulsion and growth. Everybody has to be harnessed into this one system. So that's a profound difference. The modern state was really built to do that. And there's another feature, which is that really colonialism and imperialism, that desire to sort of export the economic system and the political system to other places, is something that began right at the beginning of the modern state. It's no accident that the Americas were opened up to European conquest right about the same time that European states came in, modern European states came into being, that there was this need to extract wealth not just from the territory and the population of the state itself, but from other places too. And once you start doing that, you start extending the whole system, the governmental system, the system of defense, the system of community, of how communities are organized into those places. You know, within less than 100 years after we had the first modern states, Spain was essentially raiding Latin America for every ounce of gold it could find and exporting enormous amounts of gold and silver back to Europe, where it profoundly changed the economic system there. So there's this desire to extend the system and extend it beyond the boundaries of the existing states themselves. And that's something that there were conquerors, there were conquests, there were large territorial empires before this, but never the same way, never as obsessive or as focused on channeling everything that it found and acquired into this one particular economic model. So that's really a kind of a sign that there was a major break in, I think, in in human social and political history 500 years ago.
One of the last points you make is that states want to know everything so they can predict the future. But can you talk about that more, just this idea of states wanting to know more and more?
Yeah, this is, again, is something that goes back to the beginning of modern states when you had, you know, European monarchs who had astrologers in their courts to tell them what was going to happen next, is that the state has a kind of a, it has a built-in desire to be totalizing, to control all of reality, all of our reality, and to essentially to be able to tell what's going to happen next, to predict its own future, to predict our future. And that translates today into the work that the Defense Department did after the Second World War to promote digital computer development. That was part of an effort to create a sort of an all-seeing eye throughout the society and throughout the world, and then to take the data that was acquired and create systems that could analyze it such that they could predict what was going to happen next. That's what I'm saying is that that's always been a desire of the state, and the technology that it has today it enables it to move much more rapidly in that direction in a much more kind of technically competent way, let's say, you know, compared to astrology. Now, the corollary to that is the state can't really succeed at this. I think an awful lot of the predictive ability of artificial intelligence and so forth probably is overstated. The state and capital are probably buying products that can never really do, or developing products that never really do exactly what they think they can. But they continue to try. And I think that that's very important because it encourages them to surveil us more and more obsessively in the hope that they can figure out how to predict our actions, how to predict how their own actions are going to turn out. And so we get a much, an increasingly surveilled society. Now, this is a problem. Again, even if the state can't do it, it's important to note that the state thinks it can do it. It's pursuing this in an obsessive way, and that creates obvious problems for us as for people, for individuals, and for communities.
Yeah, yeah. What makes you hopeful in the current terrain with all that's going on?
Really, there's a lot of things, actually, that are hopeful right now. And we talked about Black Lives Matter, for example, but that's not the only thing. I mean, there are indigenous movements all over the world that are prefiguring new kinds of societies. We have the movement of the landless in Brazil. We have the rebellion by farmers in India, for example, against policies of the state that are designed to promote agribusiness. All of these are organized initially, at least, outside of the conventional political system. So there's a kind of a rolling rebellion against the state, whether that's the word people use or not, that's going on in many, many different parts of the world. And as soon as it dies down in one, it pops up in another. And those can be the beginning of a new kind of politics that is not built around the institutions we've been told are, you know, mainstream institutions that we all have to work through. And I think that combined with the disillusionment of a lot of people with the state and its failures over the last 100 years, particularly to fulfill its promises, shows that there's really more support for another kind of, or for a different kind of system or a different kind of approach to social existence than we have today. There's a lot of reasons to think that these kind of movements can network together, can work together, find common goals, and not make a lot of the mistakes that revolutionary movements have made in the past, where they try to simply recreate the thing or wind up recreating the thing that they overthrew. I do think that there is a lot to be hopeful about. I just cross my fingers and hope that, that it doesn't get co-opted.
Tell us how we can get a copy of the book and also just follow your work in general.
Yeah, the book is entitled The Operating System, An Anarchist Theory of the State, and it's available through AK Press or other mega online booksellers also carry it, I understand. But it's also available in bookstores, which are beginning to reopen all over the country. I am going to be speaking and traveling and talking about some of the ideas in the book, and I hope that people will read it and take it as an opportunity to think for themselves about the state and their experience with it and the connections they make between the elements that I talk about here. The book I'm hoping will spark conversation within the anarchist community, between anarchists and people outside of that community who are concerned about the system we have in place today. And so I am hoping to continue to be part of that.
Anything else you want to talk about that we didn't get a chance to go over, maybe?
I talked a little bit about the system of states. The fact that the state with a capital S isn't just the individual states we have, but it's a whole system that works around the world and that kind of is mutually supporting between the states themselves and with not to mention capital. And I think that really what this tells us is that when we decide to go out in the street and make our feelings known about, for example, the repression and suppression of the Palestinian people, that we are not just talking about a problem that's happening several thousand miles away to people we don't know. We're talking about something that is enforced by not just a particular state, Israel, but is enforced by a system that we are part of as well, and that we need to shake off as well. All of these struggles are connected, and in part because the system that oppresses us at home is the same system that oppresses people in Palestine, or oppresses Indian farmers, or that oppresses the Uyghur people in China, for example. That we're not these are all essentially these are all problems and oppressions and movements that have common elements that involve all of us. And so if there's a way for people to sort of think about their community's struggles as being as not identical but closely tied to those of other communities in other parts of the world, that's one of the things I'm trying to say here, is that the state is the state. It's not just a collection of countries. It's something that all of these movements are fighting against all the time. So I would just leave it at that.
This has been the It's Going Down podcast. Check itsgoingdown.org for daily updates, columns, action reports, and news. Go to itsgoingdown.org/shop to support us. And follow us on all social media platforms. IGD, your daily resource for insurgent proletarian life.